Good morning. It's good to stand before you this morning. It's good to gather together and to worship God with one another. Appreciate the visitors that we have with us this morning. Appreciate the opportunity to observe the Lord's Supper and fellowship with one another and to glorify God in the fellowship that we have in Christ. This morning, I wanted to base a lesson, I guess, around some of the thoughts that I've had on my mind recently. Brought some of them up over the Lord's Supper last Sunday, and with the offering as well. And really, the thoughts that I wanted to portray was the fact that, really, when we see in the Bible those who are considered rich or described as being rich, we should consider that to be us. Typically in the Bible, when you see somebody that's rich, it's typically referring to somebody whose needs are met. Certainly there were those who had an abundance, but typically when it refers to those who are rich of this age, consider these things. And so those are the things that we likewise should consider. I guess a point of self-disclosure that I made, though, was I tended growing up to think that those who are rich needed to give everything up in order to be a Christian. If you're rich, the way that you need to please God is to get rid of the things that you have, and that would make you pleasing to God. Over the years, I've changed my mind on that. Obviously, that's a good thing. The reality is that with the things that we have here on this earth, to whom much is given, and you can finish that, much is required. And so there's a great responsibility to those of us who have been blessed physically on this earth. Certainly all of us who are Christians have been blessed spiritually, but to whom much is given, much is required. So it's not necessarily about what we give up in this life or a quantity of sacrifice physically, but it's the perspective that we have. Ask yourself, why do I do the things that I do? What purpose do I have when I spend my money? What purpose do I have when I spend my time? We read Proverbs chapter 11 in verse 24 and 25 over the table on Sunday, talking about a man who scatters and then is blessed. And so, in other words, he's generous and then is blessed in return. And then somebody who withholds, and it's out of fear, withholds because he's, wanting to be secure, didn't want to give up something, afraid maybe that he would need it later. And that person wasn't blessed. And so, again, the concept that I want to look at this morning has really revolved around, what are we investing in? Is it things on this earth, or is it things in heaven? I gave a similar lesson about 3 or 4 years ago. I wanted to make some different applications. I think that it's become more and more of a concept that's applicable to things that we struggle with today. And so, even considering bringing in our new preacher starting next year, I've heard a lot of men make comments around the fact that maybe we need to push ourselves a little bit financially. Maybe we need to make a little bit more sacrifice to make ends meet. And I think that's a noble thing to strive for. And certainly, I have the faith that with the right perspective, that's more than possible. And it doesn't mean giving up everything that we have. It means taking on the right perspective. Greg read for us Psalms chapter 49, verses 1 through 12. I'd like to base the majority of the text that we look at this morning from Psalms 49. There are about 12 psalms that we would consider a wisdom psalm. Psalms 49 is one of those. Most of those psalms are crying out to God in one way or another, and they teach us in ways that are rather indirect or by an example. However, Psalms 1, Psalms 119, and Psalms 49 tend to be psalms that are a little bit more direct. And so I guess you could say it's a little bit easier to see the point of those and relate those to ourselves. To me, Psalms 49 seems to be particularly appropriate considering the types of things that we deal with in our society, the things that we see going on around us, the decay that we see in our nation today. It's easy to look around at the social turmoil that we have in our nation. This isn't necessarily a political discussion, obviously, but we look around and we see moral decay, we see social instability, and people seem to be more and more increasingly uneasy about those things. I think especially even Christians. And so I want to suggest to you today, it's not the first time I've made this comment, and I hope this comes through as we examine the scriptures this morning and look at Psalms 49, But I think it's a great time to be a Christian. Some of you might think that that's an interesting comment. I tried to really bring that out when we looked through the book of Acts. When we looked at the book of Acts, we had some verses that we called victory statements. And when we got to those statements, we stopped and we said, how is it possible that in these scenarios in Acts where the church is being persecuted the most, why is it always followed up by what we would consider a victory statement? And so you might be thinking, what's going to happen to the church as you read through Acts? God's people are being persecuted. The church is under attack. People are being thrown in jail. Civil liberties are being taken away. What's going to happen to God's people? And what type of verses were followed up after we saw those scenarios? I'd mentioned it. It's a victory statement. The church grew. And so that's what I want us to also keep in mind. This is weird to say, but this is a great time in history to be a Christian. Because where there is darkness, light shines even more. And so with the things that are going on in our society today, I think it's a great time to be a Christian. I believe that we're going to have, in our lifetimes, if we are who God wants us to be, we're going to have a great opportunity to make a difference. And so that's what I'd like us to look at. If we rely completely on God and pay special attention to what we are investing in. That's really what this psalm is all about. It's about learning to trust in God in challenging or difficult times. Let's read Psalms 49, if you would turn to that with me. Psalms 49, verses 1 through 4, says, hear this, all peoples. Give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together. My mouth will speak wisdom, and the meditation of my heart will be understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb. I will express my riddle on the harp. There's a universal appeal here in the first four verses. The psalmist claims that anybody can get wisdom from these four verses, or anybody can get wisdom from what he's about to say. Mentions those who are rich, those who are poor, those who are high, those who are low. If you're a person and you're listening to this and you pay attention to it, you can learn something from this. And so I want you to notice, particularly in verse 4, it's interesting that he says, essentially to paraphrase, before we start to talk, we listened first. This isn't coming from us. We lend our ear to the Lord first, to God first. We've considered that, and here's what we have to say about it. And so he begins with an absolute reliance on the wisdom of God. And so we're going to look at this this morning with the perspective of an absolute reliance upon God. So then he begins to talk about the writer here in verses 5 and 6, starts discussing a problem that we're all familiar with. Economic problems and injustices. He talks about those who trust in wealth and then contrasts that with those who don't. So let's read verses 5 and 6 of Psalms 49. Why should I fear in the days of adversity when the iniquity of my foes surround me, even those who trust in their wealth and boast in the abundance of their riches? The situation that the psalmist here envisions are days of adversity. You could say that for a Christian, these tend to be days of adversity. Difficult and trying times for those especially who are economically disadvantaged. And so those who trust in wealth and those who boast in their abundance tend to oppress those who are poor. And again, not to make a political statement of any sort, it doesn't really matter who's in office. You look throughout history, those who are rich tend to oppress those who are poor, financially. It doesn't really matter who's in power. And so James says something similar in the book of James. If you would turn to James chapter 2, verses 6 and 7. And I'll grab a section here. Essentially, James says here, it is not the rich who oppress you and personally drag you into court. It's a question there. Do they not blaspheme the fair name by which you have been called? And so it's always been there. It's always been this way. And James raises the question, why should we fear those types of situations? Why should we fear, personally, days of adversity? Now, clearly, the psalmist believes that this isn't a situation that we should fear, as we read in chapter 49. Now, it sounds like a bad situation. It sounds like a terrible situation. But he says, essentially, why should I worry about that? It may be that the rich and the powerful people are taking advantage and persecuting those who are less advantaged. And in the context of the psalm, and certainly in the context of the book of James, it tends to be those who are godly tend to be the ones taken advantage of. There's a bit of a correlation to that. Those who are meek, those who are financially poor. And in those contexts, they tend to be those who are godly. You yourself may know, personally, somebody who's been fired from their job because they didn't compromise principles. They didn't compromise their faith or their values in the Lord. And so maybe they violated some politically correct aspect of society. Maybe they wouldn't bend to do something corrupt, to cheat, to steal. There's constant social pressure to accept behaviors and attitudes that are contrary to the Word of God. And it can also be the pressure, and this is probably the most difficult one, the pressure of seeing self-important people of the world at ease, while others who are concerned about good tend to be taken advantage of. That tends to be a little bit more difficult. I'd say we probably have experienced that more, at least up until this point, than seeing somebody be fired from their job or physically abused because of that. There's a man named Asaph who struggled with something similar. In Psalm 73, I'd like to read verses 3 through 6, the story of Asaph here. And then we'll drop down and we'll read the conclusion of that. Just want to bring out a couple of verses. But Asaph struggled with this very thing, looking around and seeing those who were prospering around him and recognizing that he himself had been faithful. And so notice and see if you find yourself in what Asaph struggled with here. So Psalm 73, let's read verses 3 through 6 and then we'll read 13 through 14. For I was envious of the arrogant, as I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For there are no pains in their death, and their body is fat. They are not in trouble as other men, nor are they plagued like mankind. Therefore pride is their necklace, the garment of violence covers them. In 13 and 14, surely in vain I have kept my heart pure, and washed my hands in innocence. For I have been stricken all day long, and chastened every morning. It's interesting. Asaph sees others around him prospering, and he questions himself. Why have I kept myself pure from the world, and I've been struggling, and yet I see these others out here who don't care about godly things, don't revere God, don't fear Him, and they've got it made right now. Have you ever experienced that in your life? I want to suggest to you that the problem that Asaph struggles with here is a problem raised in Psalm 40 or Psalms 49 as well. Probably one of the biggest problems facing Christians today. I believe more young Christians fall victim to this and are carried away by the world than perhaps maybe any other single thing. They see everybody out in the world and they see them enjoying themselves, seemingly enjoying the pleasures of earth. And they look at that situation, they look at their own situation, and they think to themselves, I could be doing that. I could be enjoying those things also. And all I hear is, don't do this. Stay away from that. That's wrong. But I could, if I wanted to, I could do those things. And I'm not getting any benefit in being a Christian. And they think that to themselves. And they think, well, maybe I'll just go off and join them. That seems to be the easiest route. So even Asaph was almost there. You can see that coming out in Psalm 73. Asaph was almost there himself in making that compromise. Now keep in mind, what's ironic about this is Asaph wasn't a rebellious teen growing up and trying to figure out who he was. Asaph was a Levite. I think that's surprising. He was a leader among God's people. And he struggled with this. So certainly our young folks struggle with it. We struggle with this. All of us struggle with it. And we wonder sometimes the same thing. Why am I doing this? Why bother staying that true to Christianity? I could throw it all away and join the prosperous way of the world. So continuing in Psalms 49, let's pick up in verse 7. We see some pretty good answers here in response to that type of reasoning. Psalms 49, we'll pick up verse 7. Let's read through verse 12. No man can by any means redeem his brother or give to God a ransom for him. For the redemption of his soul is costly, and he should cease trying forever, that he should live on eternally, that he should not undergo decay. For he sees that even wise men die, the stupid and the senseless alike perish, and leave their wealth to others. Their inner thought is that their houses are forever, and their dwelling places to all generations. They have called their lands after their own names, but man in his pomp will not endure. He is like the beasts that perish. And so he makes two points here, essentially similar points that Solomon also makes in the book of Ecclesiastes. His first point, that's pretty evident, you can't pay off the reaper. No amount of power, influence, or wealth can change the fact that one day you're going to die. And that's just a reality. And really, death is no respecter of persons economically, if you think about it. If you go into a hospital, you're going to find extremely wealthy people there. You're also going to find extremely poor people there. Death is a pretty inclusive club. It's really not hard to get into, and essentially it will admit anyone, inevitably everyone. Now, you may have to wait longer than others. That's certainly not guaranteed. But acceptance into that is virtually guaranteed, unless, of course, the Lord comes first. And so, first point is, everybody dies. We need to think about that. It sounds funny that we don't consider that, but we need to think about that. That's a universal truth. And so, wealth is not going to change that. No amount of earthly success is going to change the fact that, in the end, we're all going to die. And so, the wealthy, the writer says in verse 11 of chapter 49 that we read, their inner thought is that their houses are forever and their dwelling places to all generations. They have called their lands by their own names. And so again, exposing the fact that they think that they're going to leave a legacy. They think, I'm going to build something that's enduring. And I'm going to build something that's going to stand as a memorial to me and my personal accomplishments. And so they console themselves with the idea that if I'm not going to live on, at least my name will live on, and I'll build up a name for myself. Let's take a quick break for a little bit of irony. I tend to enjoy making illustrations that tend to be a little bit more ironic. We mentioned Solomon. Think about Solomon. He was a great builder of his time. All of the possessions that Solomon had. You know how many artifacts have been found that belong to Solomon? Really not much of anything. And so one of the most wealthy guys who had one of the largest collections of material things, and certainly for the most part he was a godly man, but the point I'm making is Solomon had the most amount of stuff and we really can't find it. A little bit of irony there. I think about the Hittites in the Bible. I'm told that at one point the Hittite group pretty much ruled the entire world. And so it's ironic that if you look at a lot of historical references, a lot of people thought for a while that the Israelites made up the Hittites because they could find so little about their existence. One of the largest groups of people that ruled the world at one point was thought to have been made up because you cannot find anything about them. We look at men in Exodus. I love the story of the Tower of Babel. Men who wanted to make a name for themselves. Anybody remember what their name was? It's not even captured in the Bible. We don't know what their name was. Just a group of people wanted to make a name for themselves. And I guess to add even more to the irony, God's people were making a name for themselves at the time. And I do remember that person's name. It was the descendants of Shem. Anybody know what Shem means? Name. Literally, God's people making a name for themselves. We know their names. And those who are in Exodus don't even have their names. I've used this example before and had quite a few discussions about it. Thought about it recently even with Alec. we think about our great-grandparents. I've used this example a couple of times. But we think about our great-grandparents. What did your great-grandparents do for a living? Think about all of your great-grandparents and think about what they did over the course of their life. Most of us can't think of, at least not all of them. And so let's make it a little simpler. What were the names of all of your great-grandparents? On each side, name them off. This is your own family. It was only, what, 3 generations ago? Name your great-grandparents. Most of us can't do that. And it sounds a little bit morbid and depressing, but you could safely say that about 30 years after you're gone, not only do we not know what you did, not only did you really not leave a legacy, probably, not really do most people not know your name, your own family, 40 years later, won't even know your own name. Interesting to think about. Pretty ironic when we stop to think about building up a name for ourselves, building up a legacy. And so Solomon says something similar in chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes. Try not to be as depressing, moving on. Verse 18 of Ecclesiastes chapter 2, it says, "Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun, for I must leave it to a man who will come after me, and who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool. Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity. Therefore I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them. This too is vanity and a great evil." And again, we've gotten to a point where it doesn't sound very optimistic about this whole process of leaving a legacy. Solomon here stops essentially just short of saying, my ungrateful kids don't appreciate anything. They may not even be as wise in handling the things that I took so long to build up. And so I don't say this again to make us all depressed. I simply want to point out the success in the efforts of men to try to build something and create a legacy. How's that worked out for them in the Bible, even in days today? And so the writer comes to his refrain in Psalms chapter 49 in verse 12. We've read that. And where he says, "But a man in his pomp will not endure. He is like the beasts that perish." And so this is the chorus to this song. And you see it also in verse 20. It's repeated. "Man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beasts that perish." A little bit difficult to understand there. And so, paraphrasing, essentially what he's saying is, the advantage of the rich is that he's a little bit better than the beast. Because they both die, and that's essentially what his wealth got him. The same end result of even a beast who will eventually die. And so, we could stop here. That wouldn't make for a good lesson if we stopped here. Let's go on and find out what the writer is getting at. And so let's read 49, 13 through 20. Psalms 49, 13 through 20. "This is the way of those who are foolish, and of those after them who approve their words. As sheep they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. And their form shall be for Sheol to consume, so that they have no habitation. But God will redeem my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. Do not be afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his house is increased, for when he dies, he will carry away he will carry nothing away. His glory will not descend after him, though while he lives, he congratulates himself. And though men praise you when you do well for yourself, he shall go to the generation of his fathers. They will never see the light. Man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beasts that perish." And so from verses 13 through 20, he suggests another way to live. It's not whoever dies with the most toys wins. I think all of us have seen signs and bumper stickers like that. It really boils down to forget the toys, trust God and live. The writer here essentially has eternity in view, and that's really what I want to bring out. It's not what you have, to what you have in view? What purpose do you have in what you do? Is one of the first questions that I had thrown out this morning. The rich and the powerful are tempted to rely on wealth and the power that they have. And from what we've seen, that's folly. And the psalmist here says that that's like a sheep led to the slaughter. There's going to be a day, and he makes it clear in those verses, that the tables are going to turn. And he says in verse 15, "But God will redeem my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me." And there's the contrast. There's the wisdom of the psalm. It's not about this life in this world. It's about eternity. This life in this world is in fact doomed. We've established that. And we need to realize that the wise man always lives his life with a view of eternity. James introduces his book in the book of James with this very idea. If you turn to James chapter 1, just read two verses here, 9 through 11. James 1, 9 through 11. "But the brother of humble circumstances is to glory in his high position, and the rich man is to glory in his humiliation. Because like the flowering grass, he will pass away. For the sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and its flower falls off, and the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. So too the rich in the midst of his pursuits will fade away." So let me ask you this. How is that a good thing? James is really establishing something that's good here. How is that a good thing? I would suggest that it's a good thing because it's good when the rich person finds out ahead of time that what he's investing in is a bad investment. You obviously want to find out as early as possible if you're making a bad investment. So you can take out that capital, right, and invest it into something else. And so a brother of humble circumstances is to glory in the fact that while he may not have much to invest in this life, he has plenty to invest in eternity. And so the psalmist says, with this in view, similarly, don't be afraid. Don't fear. Don't fear those who are rich. Don't fear those who persecute, those with power. I think we see a lot of that today. Not literally that some rich ruler is going to come and take everything we own. But I think sometimes we do fear those who are rich. We do fear those who are in power. Typically, they're influential folks. Their thoughts are dictated by social norms, things that are politically correct. And we fear that. I do. And sometimes we do. We look around and we think, maybe I'm missing out on something. Maybe I'm the one that missed it. Maybe that is really where it's at. Maybe these folks really are more fulfilled than I am. Maybe these folks really are getting more out of life here on this earth than I am. Maybe it is as wonderful as they say it is. And so we're afraid. We're afraid of missing out. There's an acronym for that now. The psalmist says, don't think those thoughts. Don't be afraid. Don't have those thoughts. Don't worry that you're going to be missing out, because you're not missing out. Lay up your treasure in heaven, because that's where fulfillment is. One more bit of text I'd like to look at this morning. Luke chapter 16. It's a parable of the unjust steward. I was talking to Bree's grandfather the other day about this parable, talking about how it's probably one of the most difficult ones to understand the application point, because it sounds a little bit counterintuitive as it leads up to it. Background on the parable of the unjust steward here in Luke chapter 16 is that there was a man who was a landowner. It says he was wealthy. Well, if you were wealthy back in biblical times, it typically meant that you owned a piece of land. And so instead of managing this land himself, this landowner had a steward, and not necessarily a slave, but somebody who was his manager to manage out and cash rent his crops, vineyards. And so he entrusted all of his land to an individual who was in charge of making sure that his business was successful. And so we come to find out by the time we get to verse 8 that this man was squandering his job. He was not getting money back, and he was unjust. He wasn't getting a return on investment, so to speak, to the landowner. And so it's often misunderstood as we get to verse 8 here, but we'll take a look at it here. So, not taking care of his master's goods, he realizes that he's going to be thrown out in the street. And so he goes around, and he goes to those who owe the landowner some money, basically some back rent for the land, and he discounts it for him. And so he goes around knowing that he's about to get fired. It's inevitable. He's been unjust. He hasn't done his job. He's about to get fired. So he goes around to all of the people that owe the landowner some money, and he says, you know what? Discount that one. And he goes to the next one and says, you know what? Don't pay all of it. Discount it. And so what's he doing in that process? He's making friends with all of these people that he's about to be thrown out to. And so how would they receive him? Hey, you could stay with me. You just discounted all my debt. Took care of it, right? And so he makes friends with these people. And it sounds, if you think about the parable itself, Jesus here, he isn't explaining how to skin your masters and take advantage of them. But he commends him for one thing. In verse 8, it says, "For the sons of this age are more shrewd in their relation to their own kind than the sons of light." And so there's a lesson to be learned from this guy. There's really nothing good about him morally at all. But he has some wisdom from a worldly standpoint that we should apply as Christians. It's the fact that he thought down the road, what's going to happen to me? It wasn't just about the here and now. He made provisions that somebody might receive him, that somebody might take him in, because he knows he's about to get fired. This guy knows he's about to lose everything, and his focus has suddenly turned. How am I going to make sure I get taken care of? And so he says, you know what? This guy has no moral redeeming qualities, but at least he knows you got to think long term. And I think that's the point of the parable of the unjust steward. And sometimes it's Christians, honestly, who claim to be wrapped up in eternity, as in focused on eternity, but tend to be the ones that can't think long term. And so Jesus is making the point that if you're really wrapped up and concerned with eternity, you're going to make provisions so that when this life is over and you don't have any place to go, there's going to be someone to receive you. And so this is what he says in verse 9. "And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by the means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into eternal dwellings." That's the difficult verse. Sounds like Jesus here is saying, make friends by being shrewd and sneaky, and those are going to be the folks that take care of you when you get to heaven. I mean, on the surface, sounds pretty counterintuitive there. Let's listen and decode what Jesus is saying here, though. When he's talking about the wealth of unrighteousness, he's basically just talking about money. Literally, that's what he's talking about. He's talking about money. He's saying that one day you're going to get to a place where money isn't going to do you any good at all. It's going to fail you. And we know that because we've already read that's what the psalmist has been telling us. When we get to the end of this life, money isn't going to do us any good at all. And so how do we use something that's inherently temporal, money, for an eternal purpose? Okay. I'd like us to think about for a second. I'm not exactly sure how I'll explain this, but what is the only thing that you could invest actual money in and it lasts forever? I mean, literally, there is one thing that you could take money and invest it in, and it will last forever. Nothing else will. People. Souls. What is the one thing that we have among us today that is the only thing that is eternal? Our souls. It's the only thing that's going to be in heaven. And so, how do you invest something that's temporal, which is money, into the only thing that can last forever? We need to use what we have in this life to help other people so that they can stand before God as a testimony of the fact that we used our money in a way to please God. And what I mean by that is, and this is the point of the unjust steward, when we go to heaven, there should be people standing there as a testament that we invested our money in things eternal. Does that make sense? There should be folks up in heaven that are there because of our influence. Now, I'm not saying it's because of our works or we converted them. Certainly, that's through Christ himself and through the grace of God. But there should be people up there in heaven standing there because of how we spent our money. I think that's hard to grasp sometimes. Jesus goes on to say, "He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much." And so the little thing in this case is money. And the problem is, we don't typically see money as a little thing, but we see it as a big thing. But it's little, doesn't last, and soon, as we've mentioned, it's not going to matter. Has very little value in the grand scheme of things. And so people who are made in the image of God, that's what has value. If we invest in them, then essentially we're investing in eternity. Verse 11 of Luke chapter 16 says, "Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, money, he will entrust you with true riches." True riches are eternity. And so, if you can't be trusted to spend your money and invest on things eternally, so a little thing, how will you be entrusted with things in eternity? Parents do this with children all the time. You give them something little, you see how they handle it, you give them some responsibility and allowance of some sort, and if they don't handle it right, then you realize that they can't be trusted. You need to work on them with it. But if they can, then what do? You give them a little bit more responsibility. You build upon that. If you can trust them with something small, and they show the desire to take care of that wisely, then you give them more. It's not a concept that we're unfamiliar with. God has done the same thing with us. He's entrusted us with something little, money, opportunity, while we're here on this earth. And he's watching us. He's watching us on how we're going to handle that. And so he's entrusted us for a short time, very short time in the grand scheme of things, with something very little. Material blessings, opportunities to influence others, opportunities to invest in eternity. And he's watching us. And he's going to decide, if you can handle things that are small, I'll entrust you with things that are great. Eternity. Let me pause here for a second and illustrate something that I find a bit interesting. We've talked a lot about material things, but also opportunities. It's interesting to me that a lot of Christians that I know, I don't mean to beat us up over it, but I know a lot of Christians that say, like, on singing night, it's just singing night. I won't make the trip down tonight. I won't drive up. It's just singing night, right? Or there'll be a get-together, and it's, brother so-and-so is kind of a goofy guy, you know. I'm not a people person. I just kind of keep to myself. And it seems to me more and more that a lot of Christians neglect opportunities to spend time with one another and get too busy doing other stuff. And so whether it's singing night, I don't like singing songs, or let's only sing for a half hour or so. I don't want to sing a whole lot. Don't want to go and visit somebody who's sick. Not sure I want to spend some time with that person. Don't really want to study, especially the don't want to sing part. It's interesting to me. And what I stop and think to myself is, if you don't want to be around other Christians, if you don't want to spend time with brethren, if you don't want to praise God, if you don't want to sing songs of praises to God, why do you want to go to heaven? Isn't that what heaven's all about? Being with Christians? Being around the glory of God? I fear too much nowadays that we have a lot of Christians who just don't want to go to hell. I know that sounds a little bit harsh. But reality is, those are the things that we're going to do in heaven. And God has entrusted us in a very small way, again, to handle those things on earth. And so he's looking at us. Does Scott like to be around Christians? Does Scott enjoy singing songs of praises to me? What's Scott doing in his time? Well, if he's investing in eternity, well, then he wants to be in heaven. And so hopefully I'll be invited into heaven, right? If God looks at us, have we given him a reason to even think that we want to go to heaven sometimes? I think that's interesting. And so my point is, he's entrusted us for a few short years here on earth to handle things very similar to the things that we would be entrusted with, but yet on a much greater scale. I'd like to conclude with a thought from Luke chapter 12 in verse 16, starting in verse 16. Luke 12, starting in verse 16. And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops?' And he began reasoning to himself, saying," I'm sorry, I already read that part. "Then he said, 'This is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come, take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your soul is required of you. And now who will own what you have prepared?' So this man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God." That's Psalms 49. That's basically a good summary of Psalms 49. And that also is the outcome of what we would consider the American dream. I'm going to work hard, I'm going to save money, I'm going to build up a 401k, I'm going to have plenty of security, so I'm not afraid, and then I'm going to die. Or we could choose a different path. I'm going to work hard at serving God, I'm going to serve my family, I'm going to work hard at serving my brethren, I'm going to serve and influence my neighbors, I'm going to live my life with integrity, I'm going to trust that God's going to provide for me, and I'll be a good steward and smart about it. And at the end of my life, I'm going to live. I might die physically, but at the end of my life, I'm going to live. One is wisdom, and one is folly. One is life, and one is death. The same choice that God's people have always had throughout eternity. Even Moses, to the children of Israel, said himself, "I set before you today life and death. Choose life." And throughout the entire Bible, even when Jesus came, he encouraged those around him to choose life. If you are still investing all that you have in this world, I've said this before, but I've got a 100% guaranteed investment tip for you this morning. You're about to lose everything. You're about to go bankrupt. And I can promise you that. You need to pull your capital out of this world and invest it into something eternal. It's not a prediction, that's a certainty. And if you don't, you're going to lose everything that you have, and it's a great deal more than what you think. But if you would pull your capital out and invest in eternity, then you will reap rewards that cannot be estimated in dollars, cannot be measured in time, and are eternal and unspeakable riches. And that's our hope for you this morning, that you would come to know God through Jesus Christ and invest in eternity. If you're not a Christian, we challenge you to obey the gospel. Leave this world behind. Maybe you've had some of those thoughts we talked about and you see what's going on around you. Leave this world behind. We are all going to stand before the Lord on the day of judgment to give an account with what we did, not only monetarily, but with our time. Have you been investing in eternity? We call you to God through Christ Jesus this morning. Believe him, repent of your sins, and confess your faith in the Lord this morning, and be baptized. If you're a Christian and you've lost your way, maybe you haven't been investing in things that are eternal, make the commitment to turn that around today. If we can help you in any way to make that commitment, please do so this very morning as we stand and sing the invitation song.